Please welcome Mark Osweiler.
Thanks for the introduction. Thanks also for everyone who's come out tonight. I'm enormously pleased to be here at the Historic Society of Pennsylvania in support of the African American Historical Genealogical Society. It's been extremely important for this research project. I presented on some earlier aspects of this that is with the society earlier on, and it's just wonderful to be here. I'm really honored that the Caldwell family and friends are here with us as well. So the book really starts with a little mystery. From the town of Oxford, Georgia, this is the town in Georgia, about 40 miles outside of Atlanta, where Emory University started back in 1836. And like many southern towns, much of the local struggle with history swirls around the cemetery. It's a segregated cemetery. It has been for many generations. There's a very well-kept white cemetery, which is often called the Westminster Abbey of Georgia Methodism, enormously important figures in Georgia history, presidents and bishops in Methodist Church, those associated with Emory are buried there. Now, there's an equally important historical cemetery just across the little road, which is the Historically African American Cemetery, which for many decades was terribly neglected, partly because the all-white city council was channeling African American resources, the money people paid for their burial plot fees, to the all-white private cemetery foundation. That's a long and interesting story, all too common in many parts of the South. But right in the middle of the white cemetery, this is a mystery that struck me many years ago when I began teaching at Oxford College or University, right around the corner. There is the middle of the white cemetery, near the plot to Bishop, the family plot of Bishop James Osgood Andrew, an enormously important figure in the history of American Methodism. A monument, not to the white patriarchs and matriarchs of the city, but to an enslaved woman, identified here as Kitty. It's a little hard to see. Kitty Andrew Shell is the name by which the white community is referred to her. African Americans in town have a very different story of this woman. In fact, they refuse to call her Kitty. They insist on, to this day, addressing her as Miss Kitty. And there's a world of difference, of course, in those two names. But I was fascinated. Here was, in a deeply, still segregationist community in many respects, these monuments that had gone up, the largest one, telling the story of Miss Kitty as an enslaved woman who belonged to the very powerful Bishop James Osgood Andrew. We don't actually know what Miss Kitty looked like, but we'll get to her historical name in a minute. We know that she lived from around 1822 to 1851. One of my students has hinted at what we believe she looked like. There are, in fact, hundreds of published accounts about Kitty by white authors. And this story is deeply resented and persisted, I must admit, by the many African-American residents of Oxford and Newton County. But it's the story that has dominated written accounts. And those of you who grew up in the Methodist tradition will actually be familiar with a version of this story in the Methodist Book of Discipline, that is to say, within the United Methodist Church. So here's one standard version by a white chronicler from the was publishing precisely around the time of Brown v. Board of Education. He's deeply against the civil rights movement, and he calls, along with many other leading segregationists within the Methodist Church, for a return to the old values, exemplified by what he regards as a heroic figure, Kitty herself, as the servant girl, slave, willed to Bishop Andrew by Augusta, friend of rooted women who own the Andrew place. There she married Nathan Shell and settled in Oxford. She and her husband were respected by all as worthy members of that old Oxford colony of colored people. Her triumphant dying words were spoken to Bishop Andrew at her bedside. I shall soon see Miss Amelia, that is to say, of the woman who had owned her, along with the bishop, in the bed of the blank. And that's a story that is repeated on these grave markers. It's, as I say, reprinted in hundreds of publications. And it's been used for generations, in Georgia especially, to legitimate the institution of slavery. It's part of what was, in the early 20th century, known as the Manning Memorial Movement, an attempt to build, which was actually backed by the United Voters to Confederacy and by leading white segregationist Southern senators and congressmen, to build a national monument on the Mall to honor the Negro, or colored Mammy, as she was called. Never actually happened. But in light of all the recent debates over the health, the story, these are very powerful stories. This is a story that is deeply disputed by members of the African-American community, as I say, in Oxford and elsewhere, but also these many mysteries. The story that is officially told, and we're going to get into the more complicated story, is that Kitty, under the terms of Miss Kitty, under the terms of the will for which Bishop Andrew received her at some point in the 1830s, was offered her freedom in 1841 if she would go to Liberia, to the colony of Liberia. She refused. And the white version is out of loyalty. So she did this out of loyalty to her white master and mistress. As a reward, it is said, Bishop Andrew built her a half house, a cottage in the white for camping, and here it is, in fact, in which she was allowed to live in, quote, virtual freedom, and is said to have married a free man of color and had children with him, until she died, and in this triumph, knowing that she would be reunited with the person she was so close to, the woman who owned her. This is a cottage, as I began to listen to many voices around the story, that was deeply controversial because while it was a site of great sentimental, I would say, love and affection by many members of the white community, most African-American residents of the county refused even to walk into it. There had been an attempt by the old white historical society to restore it, and yet it was, while considered a place of love, was considered by many white residents, was considered a place of deep violation, a place where stories had come down through the community, where Miss Kitty had been forced to live as the coerced mistress of Bishop Andrew. It's very hard to sort out precisely what happened, but these are the different stories that have come down through the generations in this little town of Oxford, Georgia, tied in so closely, and there's a standard sort of white version emphasizing that she preferred to remain with the Andrew family. This is in the context of an institution like Emory, like many Southern colleges, which was founded in many respects to legitimate the institution of chattel slavery. 1836, when the institution was founded, really was a time when slavery was increasingly coming under attack from Northern abolitionists, and it was felt it was important to have a Methodist college in the South that was committed to the earlier institution. And all of the leading faculty and administrators of Emory were major slave owners. These are significant figures in the history of Methodism, especially in the history of American science, Dr. Alexander Means, Bishop Andrew himself, who was the first president of the Board of Trustees of Emory, and so forth. And we have extensive records. And many of the individuals who continue to live in Oxford and coming from Georgia are descended from people who were enslaved within this Emory circle. They physically built buildings. In many cases, their descendants have continued to work at the institution through the generations. They have a very strong sense of a critique of the injustice of slavery, at the same time a strong sense of pride in the institution of Emory, even though they felt deeply excluded for so long a segregated institution. And it's precisely at the point in the 1930s when there's a deep struggle over the future nature of American democracy. Enormous fear by white segregationists, Eleanor Roosevelt in particular, will try to desegregate Southern churches and so forth. That's the point at which this great mind, Miss Kitty, goes up by one of the leading segregationists in Georgia, a multimillionaire, H.W. McCord, who wants to honor this story of the loyal slave, and to argue that all attempts at civil rights agitation are due not only to communist influences in his mind, but also to Northern interference in our Southern way of life. So you can actually see that Miss Kitty's headstone and this marker to her was placed right on the borderline, more or less, between historically white and historically African-American cemetery, sort of mediated and so forth. That's how she was really used, to welcome people into this vision of, in fact, of heaven, of whites, that were guaranteed, in a sense, that this person that was so deeply loved, here's the cottage, in 1939 was actually moved from Oxford, 12 miles, to an all-white segregated campground, Salem campground, where it became a monument to the lost cause, a monument, in fact, to the Confederate cause in the Civil War, and was called Kitty's Cottage. Again, never called a slave camp. The word slavery was never used. It was sort of used to welcome white visitors coming for a revival and so forth. And now it comes back to Oxford in 1994 Lovingly restored, as I said, by members of the old White Historical Society, with no consultation with African American citizens, no attempt at all to contact family members, and so forth. This was bitterly resented, I would say, in many African American voices in Georgia, quietly protested. An Afrocentric church from Lithonia, an Atlanta suburb, actually came out several years ago to hold an African naming ceremony, libations, in front of the cottage, to honor, they had read some of my initial early work on this case, that complicated the question, and really called for us to try to understand a deeper part of the story, honored her, some believe that they heard her voice, that she spoke to them. They did this, I should note, with no consultation with the local African-American community, which was actually, I could say, very painful to that community, because especially women in this community, as I began to research this, women in Mount Zion Baptist Church, in Grace United Methodist Church, in Rust Chapel, in Bethlehem Baptist. These were women who said, you know, we've heard about this kitty all our lives, and that she was so terribly treated, she suffered so badly, and that the worst of it was that when she died, the Bishop Andrew's people wouldn't even allow her to be buried with her own people, that she was buried in a white family plot, that she was not only enslaved during life, but that she was taken away and placed by the bishop, who wanted to own her in the afterworld. And this sad story really was told very differently in the white community. For many whites would point to the fact that this kitty was buried next to the bishop and said, this shows how benign the institution of slavery was, because they loved this kitty. They loved kitty so much that they wanted to be with her forever. The story was very differently on the African-American side of town. But also, many older women mentioned, women of color would mention, you know, mother, grandmother, they would go and quietly pray when white people weren't around, when white folks weren't around, at Miss Kitty's gravesite. Because we thought on her, and we thought especially what happened to her children. They had heard the story that she had three children, but that Bishop Andrew, who claimed that in 1844, to have only been accidentally a slave owner and claimed he was committed to Miss Kitty being free, his ownership of slaves became the national news story in May 1844, when it suddenly became public knowledge that he was a slave owner, a prominent bishop in the Methodist Church. Methodism, a religion which had been founded, of course, as an anti-slavery institution, has a long, complex racial history, and Philadelphia is really ground zero of that great historical struggle, the question of whether or not Methodism is a universal religion, or whether it's going to be divided across the lines of race, comes to a head, as we know, in the 1780s and 1790s here in Philadelphia. And that battle continued into the 1840s. Bishop Andrew finally declared Miss Kitty wanted to be a kitty, wanted to be a slave. The other enslaved people were just happy as they were, and this led to the great national schism of the Methodist Church in 1844, which was a dress rehearsal for the Civil War. It was, in Lincoln's terms, the first unraveling of the mystic cords of union and bound together with the nation. So I've been fascinated by what this story, which has been told so often, really from the white perspective, what it meant to the white, to the African-American enslaved people who were part of the story. And also, I began to hear more and more from older members of the African-American faith community that it was vital to finally locate what happened to those three children of Miss Kitty after her death, after they were taken off in slavery to somewhere, we thought maybe Alabama, maybe Mississippi, and had those children and had their descendants in turn come to a safe harbor. And this, they said, they had been praying on for a long time. And I was told it was if I was going to write about this, the community would back it as long as I dedicated myself to the search for the descendants. So that's really sort of where I was. I mean, these were fascinating events. They were, as I say, I think a little bit resented by the local African American community, which felt these were folks that were coming in for one day and really consulted, but still it was important recognition that something wasn't quite right with the standard story. We did have records at Emory of Miss Kitty, for example, purchasing the only enslaved person who's given a full name. Everybody else is considered as boy or girl. On Bishop Andrew's account, coming in and buying sewing materials and so forth. But really the great break was several years ago, finding a Freedmen's Bank record from May 23rd, 1871. Remember that name, Nathan Chell? Now, African Americans in Newton County have always said there couldn't have been anything but Shell, because Shell was not a known African American name. But it turned out that there was a man named Nathan Boyd, who was enslaved in Newton County, who'd grown up in Blue Ridge, South Carolina, and then been brought to them. And he was owned by a man named Shell, Richard Shell. Comes out of the family of a prominent Methodist minister, so it's a very old Methodist family, as we'll see. And as you can see, he lists in 1871, this is 6 years after emancipation, that his wife is Catherine dead. And this was really electrifying for us, because the woman that we've been talking about was always known as Kitty. But to her, to her husband, she was known as, 20 years after her death, she was known as Catherine. And and he insists on using her full name, not a diminutive name, not an enslaved name, Catherine. The children, Alfred, Nathan, and then L, the father Richard, the mother Judith dead, the brothers, the sisters, and all of this matches up, in fact, with the court records that are in Newberry, South Carolina, in the courthouse, showing how the enslaved man Richard and his wife Judith, how their children were all broken apart at this period in 1822, after the death of the Methodist minister, Richard Shell, Stephen Shell. And now we come down to the next generation, Nathan Boyd, who is brought by his owner, Stephen Shell Jr., to Covington, Georgia, who actually is the clerk of the court, and Catherine, or Kitty, is the woman he marries, and who recognizes his children, even though that's often 20 years later. So, Bishop Andrew, it turns out, did in 1855, in fact, moved to Alabama, to the little town of Summerfield, in Dallas County, just north of, Selma, Alabama. And we do have records that we've been able, luckily, to reconstruct. Alfred, or Alford, as he was named, Russell Nathan, now Russell Emma. Emma does marry in Summerfield. He learned into a sharecropping family, eventually moves to Arkansas. The second son, Russell Nathan, actually makes his way to Washington, D.C., first as a house servant in an important naval family, white naval family, and then obtains employment in the U.S. Department of State and becomes a very important librarian. For a time, his duties include being the keeper of the Declaration of Independence. He is also on the great 1903 expedition to London, the delegation to London, and negotiates the Alaska Canada boundary, because he's the keeper of maps. He becomes a senior trustee in the 50th Street Presbyterian Church, working with Reverend Francis Grimke, and is very involved in the great period of religious and political ferment that leads up to the establishment of the NAACP and other things. He passes in 1921. But Alfred's story is absolutely extraordinary. As far as we can tell, those two lines, however, of Russell Nathan and Emma had not continued, but it's different for the story of Alfred. So I'll move forward a little bit. And this is really an extraordinary story that gives me chills every time I think about it. So Alfred Boyd does indeed make his way to Keosauqua, Iowa. Now, this is a little town, so at the moment we saw this record that he was married in Keosauqua, Iowa, my wife Ellen, who's very involved in this story, insisted that we should drive there from Atlanta. She was sick and tired, she said, of this mystery remaining unsolved, and we were able to get up there. So we got to Keosauqua, Iowa, which was rather important in the Underground Railroad, and we actually saw a sign for the Underground Railroad house. We went there. There was an elderly white woman there who was devoting herself to retirement to caring for this place. And we told her that we were looking for a man named Alfred Boyd. She thought about this for a while, invited us to her house for ice cream sandwiches while she brought her up. This man said, you know, grandmother used to talk about this family. They were members of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And that's very interesting. So she said, you know, you said you were looking for Methodists. And we wouldn't expect him to stay in the Methodist Episcopal Church South, that racist segregationist church, would you? So, and last I heard, they went to Des Moines. Now, that was about 110 years ago. I said, so, maybe you should be able to find them. So I phoned up every AME church in Des Moines. I really don't know. There are, I realize, I have something better genealogical research techniques I could have tried. I was also in society, but that's what I did. And 2 days later, I get a phone call back from the phone rings, and it's a woman who says, this woman in her 80s, an African-American woman, who says, this is Linda Walker Webster, and I understand you've been asking questions about my great-great-uncle. We've been trying to find that side of the family. Lost track of them about 9 years ago. I did hear they were in Ottumwa. And from that led us to other records that indicated that Alfred Boyd had indeed settled in Iowa and had become an ordained minister, a pastor in the African Methodist Episcopal Church indeed, and had pastored many congregations in Iowa and Illinois all the way up through his life. He lived until 1926. And here we see the line. He married into the Buchner family line, who were indeed escaped people who come in through the from Missouri into Keosauqua through the Underground Railroad, and had children. Here we see the names, Mary Catherine, so Catherine, again the name, the historical name that Miss Kitty herself would refer to herself by, Catherine, that name reappears, that name Russell that we've seen, Nathan, and so forth. Again, some confirmation of the interlinked natures of the stories coming down. The next generation to Bertha Bradley, Mary's Lyle Caldwell, and in Rockford Home. I didn't know this part, but I was sort of despairing because I had seen records that suggested there was a Rockford connection. I knew that Reverend Boyd had pastored at the church in Allen Chapel in Rockford, but I wasn't getting a call back. Then suddenly I got a call from Miss Linda Walker Webster, who says, Rockford! I know that pastor. Let me have a talk with him. And 5 minutes later, I get a call from a very chastened pastor who's thrilled that we have information from church history and arranges to take us over to, in the most thrilling day of my life, to actually meet Mr. Caldwell, who is Reverend Boyd's great grandson, and that was a trustee. And he welcomed me extremely warmly. I was so nervous as we went in there, and he made me feel so at home. It was very funny. He teased the poor pastor unmercifully over various things. And then sat me down, turned to me, and said, "Now, young man, what can I do for you, and what can you do for me?" And that was a marvelous moment. He explained that he knew nothing of the earlier part of the story, and referred me to his wonderful daughters, who are the family history specialists. He knew some of the story. And as we'll hear in a minute, they knew a great deal of the history, an extraordinary amount of the history, because they've been so close to their grandmother Bertha, who had in fact been raised by Alfred and Albina. So it was really quite miraculous that all the different parts we were able to figure out from countless stories, as we'll hear, that indeed Alfred had come north. Eventually, the National Archives records indicated he seems to have come with the 3rd Iowa Cavalry through Somerville, Alabama on April 3rd, 1865. And every member of that company K that came through Somerville was about to be a softball, so it explains how it gets up there, attached as a quote, not enlisted, but associated with it. And then this led us really to a wonderful series of events when the descendants, Darcel and Bertha Caldwell, known to so many people in this room, consented to come down to the community. There was so much excitement, and I can't tell you, in Oxford and Covington. And it seemed very important since we knew that that Nathan, Miss Kitty's husband, their great-great-great-grandfather, had been buried in Oakland Cemetery in downtown Atlanta, and the cemetery collaborated with us. We were able to reflame. Just an amazing moment to have the families reunited. Those key documents at Emory University that have been very lovingly preserved, to finally have the family members come and see the physical traces of the family history, all the hints that have finally led us to be reunited. And this attracted enormous interest by the community, who wanted to create some way to welcome them back. There was a lot of discussion. Was food sufficient? Should there be a party? But then there was a lot of discussion about art and about quilting, and the community decided in conversation with a local African-American artist, a very distinguished artist, Lynn Marshall Lindemeyer, who you see here, to create a large work of art that would welcome the Caldwell Boyd family back home. to get to know all of the families that they had known. And so people began to scan in family photographs, some photographs coming from the Caldwell Boyd line, others from local families. The families from which those three children had been torn apart in the 1850s, separated from Nathan, who never, as far as we can tell, got to see his children again in slavery times, and worked in the church, slowly sewing together all these stories and creating this enormous quilt, which hung in the old church in Oxford, where so much of the story took place, and was then unraveled or unrolled, honoring all of these stories, putting together. Here are the young people of the community reading the names of all of the enslaved people who were held in Oxford, many of them built Emory College, and of course honoring Miss Kitty and her children, all together as the piece descends, and it was just an extraordinary moment, as you can see. All those different stories, the names of enslaved people. Here we see, here we see Reverend Alfred Boyd and Melvina, who for the community had really come home. But there were other homecomings as well. One of the things that the community really wanted to honor was other descendants that were tied into the story. So the third president of Emory, Bishop George Foster Pierce, again, a very noted segregationist leader, a great supporter of the separation of the church away from the Northern Church over the issue of slavery. So it turns out that not only a white family, but also an African-American family. One of his sons becomes later, the minister, and his son, in turn, becomes the great African-American mathematician, Joseph Pierce Sr., who we see here, Richard Clark Atlanta, but also becomes the president of Texas Southern University, and so forth. And so it seemed important to the community to honor all of those family connections, as well as welcoming back the Caldwells. And here is his son, a very noted African-American anesthesiologist, and his wife, Arnetta, who traveled away to be here to be part of the whole welcoming, and next to the city, here they are, next to the photograph of his father, and to really tie in. So this was a fascinating struggle by the community to finally honor all of the family connections that have been forgotten. And, well, there's so much we can say about the quilt. There was no photograph of that the local community could find of those children that were taken away. But they did use this picture of two enslaved young African-Americans on which they wrote the word gifted to emphasize that these were young people who were gifted but also were given away as gifts. So a very poignant image, which would sense. And finally, here we are in the cemetery. Now this name, Kitty Andrews Shell, is not a name, of course, that's historically accurate, we now know. She never seems to refer to herself by Shell. She and her universal children use the name Boyd, a married name. But here, they're fixing the appropriate place still to lay her to remember. But there's been a lot of discussion, and the Oxford City Council has recently voted, as they should, that a new headstone will go in, with the wording. There's been some discussion of the wording, and with a lot of help from the family. So there will be, as of October 23rd, a new headstone going into the city's expense to rectify, they note their historical inaccuracies. Catherine Andrew Boyd, the interdate, beloved wife, mother, and member of the Oxford Emory communities. It was really felt by so many people, and this was my wife and I were just down at the Grace United Methodist, and everybody was saying, look, she wasn't only an enslaved person as part of her life, but she was so much more than that. She wasn't just a symbol to be battled over, she was a full woman with a complex life, and she was a full member of all of these communities, and that has to be acknowledged. So that's a brief introduction to the story of the book. I want to thank the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, Robbins Bookstore, Newstown Art Center, of course, the Caldwell family, who has been such wonderful partners, and their friends as well. And I do also want to thank my mother, who has traveled from Washington, D.C. today. So thank you. So we have time for some questions, and I'd love to. Yes.
Fantastic.
My son, Pierce, is actually
in Texas.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm overwhelmed by this, and to know you all, it's wonderful. Can you share a little bit more about the healing that's going on in the community? Is that continuing?
Yes, it's wonderful. I mean, you know, it's always two steps forward and maybe one back. So, I mean, this guy's kind of had a lot of other struggles. In the process of searching for the descendants, people started to talk about a lot of other injustices in the community. So the search for Kitty became inseparable from the fact, for example, people started saying, well, things haven't changed so much in some ways. Because when this project started, the police force was all white, and remains all white. So initially there had to be a lot of struggle and polarization, I would say, for any human to take place. Reconciliation without justice isn't much reconciliation, you know. So community members really started to actively protest the segregation of the police department, of the cemetery, and so that whole story of the cemetery foundation that has to be worked. There were a lot of issues around environmental issues, where environmental toxins were being dumped and so forth in certain neighborhoods, which had a lot to do with where lines of race and class. So it was a long, hard process. I mean, there were important municipal elections in the city council that took place. So I would say there's been a lot of progress. I still think, you know, things could be done better, but I must say, I think what happened, it was, you know, I did something interesting about southern communities. I think the leadership in both parts of the community realized that the locals weren't actually willing to visit Oxford, everything changed. Because then the question became how to properly welcome them back. So a lot of axes got buried, a lot of hatchets got buried. And that process, I think, was working on the artwork, of thinking about how things would come forth, come together, really was transformative. So we had a big talking circle in February to welcome back the Caldwell Boy line. And it really was pretty amazing, the things that happened. The Emory Board trustee suddenly got a little nervous, really, and did partly mark this occasion and the coming international conference on slavery at universities that Emory was hosting. Did finally get around to issuing an official statement of regret for Emory's, for the university's entanglement in slavery and the sin of Jim Crow. Some people would have liked more, but it was still for them an enormous step. And it had an electrifying impact, not only in Oxford, Georgia, but throughout the state of Georgia. And it did lead to interesting moments. So Virgil Edey, for example, who's a direct descendant of Professor Stone, who just saw him as the largest slave owner on the faculty, he's always been praised for his family because they were the secret benefactors of Emory after the Civil War. And he stood up after Darcel and Cynthia spoke and said, you know what I realized? The real benefactors in Emory, the reason Emory stood up after the war, was the fortune that my father had, was of course entirely due to the labor of 19 enslaved people whose names we've just seen on this quote. And they are the ones that should be recognized. Now, for him, that was an enormous step. Everybody's moved, I'd say, different paces. But it has made a difference. And I think that's one of the things we're also enormously concerned about, race and justice in the society. And there are many important abstract principles we have to keep in mind. But I think we always kind of have to try to look at that as well as the human story. And that's what I think is so important about the story of Miss Catherine, of Catherine Boyd, and of her descendants, because it reminds us that these were full, complex human beings whose most fundamental human rights were challenged, but who also persevered. So it's a story of faith that I think is deeply inspiring to everybody across the spectrum of Oxford. So I think step by step, yes, healing is taking place, but always healing dependent on a measure of justice. Other questions or thoughts? Yes, sir.
When did this actually take a snowball effect into the book?
When did I into a book? It was about 3 years ago. I thought this was a fascinating story. I wasn't actually going to get to worry about it. Because if I couldn't find the family, it didn't seem a story. And then it was really once those different documents I was able to come across, put them together and realize
There was a serious likelihood of finding this sentence. I was that book. It had to be written up as a book. And really, that's the title. It's the accidental slave owner. Bishop Andrew called himself an accidental slave owner, so that's the first part of the title. Revisiting a myth of race, I did want to think about myths, but it was really in talking to the Caldwell sisters, I would say, who said, look, the family has to be in the title, and that was absolutely right. So that's why that full title is the accidental slave owner, revisiting a myth of race, and finding an American family. And it's, of course, it's not only finding the Caldwell the white family, but in a sense, it's finding our collective American family, being reminded that that these separations are deeply distorted of American history. This is the story of who we are as a united family, not always a happy family, but this is who we are as a people, and we need to recognize, by looking at the very specific details of these stories, the kind of work that the Genealogical Historical Society does, as a way of recognizing our common humanity and our most general interconnectedness. So it was really, it was making those breakthroughs and finally being able to work with the family in partnership, I think, that turned the thing into a book. Well, I know we have limited time. So Larry does have books for the book story, and for those who are interested, I'm very happy to sign any books. And again, I want to thank Larry, I want to thank the Historical Society. And I do this, I don't want to put you on the spot, but would I introduce yourself to those who don't know? Come on up, and
don't be shy, sir.
One of the things that Mark didn't mention, I'm Cynthia Caldwell. One of the things that Mark didn't mention is when he invited us to come to Oxford, Georgia, to be a part of the conference and also to meet the community. It was really a little bit scary to me because I knew the different stories, the white community story, the African American community story, and I didn't know how we would be received. And I was overwhelmed from having the police department to close down streets to give us personal, you know, guides throughout the community, to meeting people in the community, and they were so welcoming and so kind to us. I think the other thing that's also very interesting is I knew my family history to Alfred Lloyd and I heard of Miss Kitty, but I had no idea of how important she was to the Emory community and specifically the people in Oxford, Georgia. And I had to go there to see that. I also like to thank Mark because you have given me another generation of my family, someone that I worked with her to protect, in terms of how Kitty is viewed. There were many, many stories about her, who she was. I don't think I'm not going to say, alright, I'm not sure what the people are going to say. This is my great-great-great-grandmother. And, you know, I mean, her reputation was something that was important to me. But thanks to Mark, and also thanks to Ellen's wife. You mentioned Ellen so briefly. It was a phenomenal woman who, in terms of going through the journey with Mark, said, let's get in the car, let's do it. And talking to her, looking through history, what about this connection? And I think a good partner for you and also very helpful for us in terms of thinking about our family history. That said, one thing that I will say to you, Mark, two comments. One, it's Kisatla.
Yes.
And the other is, and this is actually an interesting family issue. Alfred Lloyd, my grandmother told me it's not Alfred, it's Al Ford. And she said, don't get confused, it's Al Ford, A-L-F-O-R-D. It's okay. So in speaking to Mark, I also say that, I mean, I realize that the records might have something different, but grandma knows. So as you read through, they may have it as Alfred, but it's Al Ford. And I just like to thank all of you for coming. I would especially like to thank my members of my book club, our book club, for coming. A phenomenal group of African American women who, at times we say it's not about the book. In this case, I think it is. and Darcel, do you have any comments?
Sure.
Oh, by the way, I am Cynthia Gold. I am so pleased to see so many friends here, and some of you knew about the story when I first heard about it, which was July 17th, 2009, which was probably one of the worst days of my life and also turned out to be one of the best days. I mentioned the story to people and they were like, amazed. They wanted to know more about it. And it was such a complicated story. They tried to get it straight. And I didn't even know all of the information myself. And I'm still learning more and more. So, but people all along the way have been very helpful and supportive of this whole thing. And I want to thank all of you for that. And of course, Mark and Helen, that goes without saying. Terry asked a question about healing. And, the commemorations for Miss Kitty, our ancestral mother, I had to come up with the term living great, great, great grandmother, so I came with ancestral mother. Cynthia and I were sort of like, we were the focal points of a lot of this. And we both wanted to make sure that everyone knew and understood that we were just representatives of it. Because it wasn't just about Miss Kitty. And the people of Oxford who gave us, they made that day, the Catherine and Nathan Quaid Day, we got a proclamation and all that sort of thing. But when Emory signed there, when they came out with their statement of regret, which was termed with the Conference on Slavery and University and with our visit there, and in fact, Cynthia and I were there, to say to the Oxford and Covington community, well, this is these kids, we're bad, but we are also you. And we had to thank them because they knew this kid. They knew our ancestral mother, and we didn't. And so their gift to us was Miss Kitty. And for some reason they thought we were a gift to them. But just the same, it's been a very humbling experience. A very enlightening experience, and we feel very, very fortunate because there are millions of African Americans that have not even a single clue as to where they come from. And the fact that Mark and Alan through their research has provided so much information to us is truly, truly a gift. And I feel that since I'm fortunate to be recipient of this, I kind of view myself as a steward of that for all other people who don't know where their people came from. And it's not just African American people, you know, a lot of folks don't know about their roots, but I feel especially grateful to have that opportunity. So, I'll sit this way.
Just one more comment. Actually, it was a little bit scary. Because when Mark and the students started his work 10 years ago and tracking down Miss Kitty, he also gave us another generation of our family. Because, and we will see in the book, Nathan Lloyd's parents, Richard and Judith Shell, I have two generations, and so it's my children's great, 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 great grandparents that Mark is identified. And as my sister said, we are very fortunate. Thank you, Mark.
Just one more question. Mark, did you have any repercussions about getting this book from Emory?
Well, I would say that's a good question. I think the initial inquiries, and this goes back to the healing question too, did make a lot of people very upset at Oxford. I did give a public lecture on the initial research. Just when I started this, pointing out a lot about slavery, a lot about the long history of sexual abuse in the county directly against women of color, that this story might well be associated with. And within a day, things started to happen, I would say. I started getting a series of cards under my windshield in my local store, in a library carrel, that had an eye, a large eye painted on it. The eye of Oxford is watching me.
And I think, you know, as many of my African-American students and colleagues pointed out, these were the same. The iconography of the same cars that the Klan, of course, had placed people's houses under the windshields the night before. Houses were shot at, or people were shot. So this gave us a sense of, and the other work that we were doing against environmental racism, the Sacred Police Department, didn't seem to inspire the same rage as questioning the standard story. It gives you a sense of how powerful this particular myth of race, because it threw open to question of, you know, this idea, questioning the idea that Miss Kitty had actively chosen to stay in slavery, and pointing to historical evidence that suggested that this was a highly coerced statement. And in any case, what kind of choice does it make? One moment that a 19-year-old makes, one instant, one thing that she says, condemned her and her children to a lifetime of slavery. So those are repercussions. Well, you know, some colleagues liked this, some colleagues didn't in the school. I would say that the university administration, though, although they got apparently scores of letters going to be fired over this one, did step up to the plate in defense of academic freedom. And the current president of the university, James Wagner, has really been a very committed advocate for integrity, for social justice, and was just here speaking in Philadelphia, I think, and was thrilled to see you there. And really, I think he feels this is one of the most important things that's happened during his tenure, is the university beginning to hold up a series of narratives on history. And he's been very committed to diversity issues, and really sees this story as vital to the identity of the institution. So, mixed record maybe, but largely the positive ones. Great. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, once again, there are books in back. There's also a flyer of the other events that take place at Williams Center, which is two blocks away. Also, the next program we're doing here is on November 2nd. As part of our People's Civil War series that looks at, in an interesting way, very parallel to this, but what the individual as opposed to the institutions that drive history. The reason this program is on November 2nd is that it will be the 150th anniversary of the firing of General Fremont by Abraham Lincoln. Fremont was fired for issuing his own proclamation of emancipation in Missouri, and President Lincoln ordered him to rescind it, and he refused, and on November 2nd he was fired for doing that. So we're looking at the whole issue of emancipation and the process and struggle towards emancipation that took place before the Emancipation Proclamation, and the significance of individual action and public action in creating policy. So I hope you can join us on November 2nd. We'll have a great panel talking about emancipation and the struggle for racial justice. Thank you very much for attending tonight.